You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 24th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rolling Stone contributor, author of Arms and the Dudes and other best-selling books, frankly. On his piece in the New York Times Magazine, an insurance salesman and a doctor walk into a bar and end up at the North Pole. Yes, folks, just a momentary break from politics, although we will get his take on the politics of the day. Also on the program, UN tribunal convicts Serbian leader for genocide. And it's Clinton's mentors lament Obama to release Argentinian dirty war docs. Zubik went to oral questioning yesterday at the Supreme Court. Don't look good, although there's only eight of them. North Carolina passes a transgender discrimination bill, a pro-discrimination bill, in the dead of night last night. Well, 10 p.m. And Donald Trump, I don't know if this is the tweet that will... And look, nothing's going to stop him with the Republicans. I actually think this probably helps him. But normal people continue to find Donald Trump increasingly distasteful because they're normal.
My limbic system outrides my mammalian brain all the time, and it's fantastic.
Paul Ryan apologizes for using words that have come back to haunt him, but still believes everything that inspired those words. And woe if true, folks. It appears God may be using terror attacks to embarrass Barack Obama. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Maybe we should get to that story first, because if this is true, this is going to be a problem. But before we do, I just want to do a shout-out. Our good friend Jay at the Best of the Left. Many people who listen to this program, I don't know how many, but a significant amount, I believe.
One of your producers.
Really?
Are you talking about found out about this show through Best of the
Left? Is that how you did it?
Yep.
Wow.
You didn't know that story?
I probably did, but I forgot it. You know, just in one ear, what out the other ear.
Once great, I, Matt. Once fascinating. I, next.
You probably told me that during our interview. I just blotted it out. I wanted to think it was because you just were familiar with my work and just in the ether. But many people, including our producer, apparently, came to this program as a function of Best of the Left. And this is amazing to me. In a way, because I feel old. But he posted episode 1,000, was it last night or the night before? This week. And he launched in January 2006. So it's been 10 years plus to reach episode 1,000. Now, you know, not for nothing, we're on like episode, like, I don't know, 1,400. But nevertheless, it's not a competition in that way. Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's the metric I'm going to use, because if I use other metrics, I might lose.
Only use the metrics where you win.
Of course.
You know this.
Of course. And we've been doing it for less time, so we win in that respect, because this is like golf in that regard. Folks, check it out. Just going back, just looking at the list of stuff that was happening in 2006, Sandra Day O'Connor was warning about the right-wing attacks on the judiciary. I don't even, I think it was Cornyn. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure it was Cornyn who got up in the Senate and said, well, I understand why people are attacking the judiciary. If they stop making rulings that are inappropriate to lunatics, then the lunatics won't do anything about it. I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
Some people think the earth is flat and gay people should be locked in cellars. And if they ain't responded to, they're going to do things.
It really is about respecting their religious and liberty choices.
By the way, I'm a moderate establishment Republican, and I deplore Donald Trump.
Right, exactly. And that was around the time that Dick Cheney shot his friend in the face, and his friend apologized for it. I'm sorry,
that's
my face.
Power.
I'm sorry, my face got in front of your bullets.
Power.
And
one man with all that power.
Conyers was talking about impeachment hearings. I think in 2006, I actually moderated an impeachment panel put on by Harper's Magazine. John Conyers, Lewis Lapham, Elizabeth Holtzman, a couple other people I think were on that panel. And John Conyers had a big book. I mean, like a big book. Glenn Beck was hired at CNN at that time. And now the guy is off his rocker. Well, wait a second. He was off his rocker then, but now he's really, now I'm concerned. Because there's a bloating going on that I think is. All right, let's get this story out of the way, too, because, folks, if this is true, this is going to be a problem. Michelle Bachmann. writing
all
in
right,
WorldNet.
It's not true. Great.
Right, exactly. In WorldNet Daily today. I just want to remind you, like, here's the thing. Over the next 6 months, we're going to be talking more about, because, you know, Trump is more than likely to be the Republican nominee, although if they, you know, they may stop him. I mean, theoretically, they could make a rule on day one of the Republican convention, as far as I can tell, saying if you won delegates in these states, they're not yours. I mean, they could do whatever they want, and they might, because we got polling out today that just shows like this is going to be a disaster for them. But as everybody tries to make this about Trump, remember, Michelle Bachmann also had her moment in the sun as a considered and a serious candidate for the Republican nomination 4 years ago. And she was one of the remember, she gave one of the responses to the State of the Union carried live by CNN. I mean, and now she's on WorldNet Daily saying that, or maybe our president's humiliation comes in a manner so devastating, it makes one wonder whether the creator of humankind isn't reminding this world of the inferiority of foolishness in the face of wisdom. The president once again mocked his nemesis, the Jewish people, and the nation of Israel by cleverly turning the international press corps toward his brilliant work in Cuba. She goes on to write, this week, some 2,000 years ago, a Jewish savior named Jesus willingly gave his life as a substitutionary sacrifice to pay for all the sins of all humankind to reconnect us with the God who made us. This compare and contrast of competing worldviews was soberingly and glaringly revealed. In other words, a raving lunatic was at least competitive in the Republican primaries in 2012. She was, in 2011, such a luminary that she was dubbed by CNN relevant enough to the Republican Party that she would get her own State of the Union response. And people wonder, like, where did this all come from? We didn't see this coming at all. Gosh, there was that one blip, Sarah Palin, but aside from that, nothing.
There was an attack in Brussels. All right, whatever. Look, let me get back to this great Jew material I'm working on for the Argentines. Why do Jew guys like to watch pornos backwards? Because that's where the hooker gives the money back. Boom!
All right.
I'm mocking my nemesis, the Jewish people.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We come back. The great.
What's the difference between a Catholic wife and a Jewish wife?
He lost it.
Catholic wife has real orgasm, fake jewelry.
All right. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report, on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. Perhaps, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but perhaps, so I'm just going to say, I'm going to give myself some wiggle room just in case I ever get called on this. But on the phone is perhaps my favorite guest that we have on the program. One of my favorite writers of some incredibly bizarre stories and fascinating stories. He is reported all around the world. Writer for Rolling Stone, best-selling author of the most recent Arms and the Dudes. And here to talk about, among other things, because he also did some reporting in the Balkans, an insurance salesman and a doctor walk into a bar and end up at the North Pole, which you can find. We have a link to it in the New York Times Magazine of the past week. Guy Lawson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam. And let's just italicize that perhaps.
Yeah, that's exactly. We're just gonna we got to put a little bit of asterisk next to it, just because I don't want to offend. Run into another guest and have them say, like, I thought I was your favorite guest. Although I don't think I've ever said that.
I don't want Sarah Silverman thinking that or
right.
Janine or anybody.
Right,
like
exactly. Now, I have to say, also, let's just start off with this here. Folks, follow Guy on Facebook and Twitter. We have the links at majority.fm. Guy is sort of a classic, not great a promoter. I noticed that on your email, Guy, it still says that Arms and the Dude, you can pre-order it.
I'm afraid this whole culture of self-promotion just kind of leaves some of us in the dust. I'm doing my best.
I know, but
the technology thing, this whole internet thing is really, I think it's going to catch on. I really believe in it.
There you have it, folks. There's some investment advice. So if you have any opportunity to get into this internet thing. All right. Let's talk about this piece because, one, I'm psyched to just talk about something that I find really interesting in a myriad of ways that isn't about politics. But then we got to talk politics because you know, you walks amongst us as if you're one of us, but you're actually Canadian. And so you have an interesting perspective on things.
Fifth column.
Exactly. All right. Well, so the story of this North Pole expedition, which, as you dug into it, you found may have been the first expedition there by just a guy. It started in a bar.
Yeah. So my wife says to me a few months ago, "Why don't you write a happy story just once in your life? Just find a happy story." Because I've been writing about prisoners and criminals and wars and everything for years and years, crime. And so my agent said, he's also my buddy, he said, "Why don't you do an adventure story?" So I literally Googled adventure stories. And it comes up with Mount Everest, the moon, the South Pole, and one of them was the North Pole. So I just clicked on the North Pole. I'm just reading about it, and it says that this guy, Robert Perry, got there in 1909, and he looks exactly like you'd expect the first guy to get the North Pole to look like, with his fur and his beard and black and white kind of, you know, etched out photograph. But then it says, but he was almost certainly lying in his logs. He couldn't possibly have done what he claimed to have done. So I'm like, huh. And then it says Frederick Cook got there, and he was the other guy that claimed to have got there, but he was also lying. So now I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll do a story about all the people that lie about going to the North Pole. And then I ask the question, well, who was first? And I'm reading along, and I'm like half an hour into it, and then there's this reference to this guy named Ralph Plaisted. And it's sort of referred to as a joking aside. It says, you know, actually, the first person to get to the North Pole was Ralph Plaisted with his buddies from Minnesota in 1968 on snowmobiles. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm in Minnesota a week later talking to the families, going through their basements and digging out boxes. And it's not that he was maybe the first expedition to get there. He was the first expedition to get there. And the only one in that time was objectively verified and true to, and it's a true story. So it's an amazing story of a bunch of Minnesota suburban dads on a bar bet going to the North Pole, which sounds sort of goofy and easy, but in fact was really pretty dangerous and difficult.
Well, yeah, I mean, these guys really had not gone on expeditions before. I mean,
they're knuckleheads.
Well, all right, so talk about the just start with the they had written that my favorite, well, one of the parts of this I love is the notion of that book that Plaisted wrote, or I don't know if he
participated
wrote.
Participated in, yeah.
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 Just the it's First to the Pole, is that the name of the book?
Yeah, and it's a classic. It's just a classic example of how a great story can be buried inside a not very well-told, book.
But why does it start off with, this is a work of fiction, and then the first words in the book are, this is a true story?
I think it's just because the publisher is this tiny little outfit in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and they were just wanted to avoid any liability. And there's lots of factual errors in the book, and a lot of the people involved, the family members, are upset about the book, and it just didn't do the justice to the expedition. National Geographic had wanted to write the story, and that would have, of course, guaranteed them a place in history and legitimacy, but they'd been really disrespectful in the beginning of Plaisted when he went to meet with him in Washington. They told him that a bunch of his cronies just couldn't go off to the North Pole. And he said, you can, in great Midwestern style, said, you can just sit there and watch me. So he had an antagonistic, 10th grade dropout relationship with the establishment, which was really harmed their ability to get recognition. Not to mention the fact they went on snowmobiles, they didn't use dogs and sleds and stuff. So, but inside that First of the Pole was the kernel of an amazing tale, and I was able to verify it through journals and letters and talking to surviving members of the expedition. And, there's this true story that emerges that it's like the anti-expedition. Expeditions in historical terms are like, you suffer. You go out onto the ice, and you're there for months, if not years, and you nearly starve, and you have to eat the dogs. And you come back emaciated, and you're a hero. And these guys had no desire to suffer on their expedition. They had every desire to do to have it as easy as they could. So they had air support. They had beer and steaks and smokes brought to them out as they progressed to the North Pole. I mean, it's kind of like a parody, but at the heart of it, when you get further into it, as you know, Sam, from reading it, you discover that these guys really were heroic.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there was a certain, I mean, a certain amount of suffering, but it also, I mean, this, these guys, it's, they just stumbled through this, but they also did it multiple times, right? I mean, they failed the first time.
The first time they go to the North Pole, they're out on the ice for the first day. They've never been in the Arctic before. Ralph takes the lead, and he starts aiming towards this iceberg in the distance. Within an hour, because it's difficult to keep your sense of direction in the magnetic north, and the ice has very few landmarks, and it's just, it's a really tough place to navigate. Within an hour, they were heading south. I mean,
direction.
About like you and I would do if we set out, Sam. You know, it's just like a couple of dudes, you know, a bunch of guys in snowmobiles just wee. But they figured it out. They took the, you know, they got defeated the first year, and they, rather than sort of skulk away, they came back, and the next year they triumphed.
And the, what was also interesting, well, that part about him sort of, you know, walking into the National Geographic offices in New York and them looking at him like, you're just an insurance salesman from Minnesota. Yeah. You're not going to do this. What I found really interesting about it too was just sort of like, you'd imagine that there would be that someone would have taken it upon themselves to write a definitive history of who was at the North Pole first. I mean, that's a fairly big deal, but because of his relationship with the gatekeepers of this type of information, it's completely submerged. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just, you know.
They held this, you know, the naval at the Naval Academy in Washington and Maryland. They had a huge seminar on Peary and the authenticity. But you know, the New York Times and the National Geographic Society had sponsored Peary in 1909. Peary was a friend of Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he was a national hero in his day. You know, the irony here is that the authentic hero, which is, you know, Robert Peary, the guy who did it the real way, was a fraud.
Right.
And the inauthentic guy on snowmobile told the truth.
And history, so, I mean, it gives you a good example of how history is sort of made and written. I mean, you would think this is a fairly, you know, sort of objective thing where you wouldn't have, but it really is a sort of proximity to the institutions that keep these records that creates reality.
Well, and narratives that conform to pre-expectations.
Right.
You know, if you are like a mustachioed insurance salesman from Minnesota, somehow your life is less authentic, less even valuable than some lying dude from, you know, 100 years ago who was able to fool, and you know, not just fool, but because they wanted to believe him. He was able to prey upon the vanity of his sponsors and the glories of this golden age. And, you know, another thing to say is, like, the age of exploration and the age of discovery has not ended. And I was really, one of the things that astonished me most was the lack of, that no one else had taken upon themselves to actually try to go find out what the heck happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe I was first to the boxes, so to speak.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing. It's amazing. I mean, this happened 40 years ago, 50 years ago now.
Yeah. The kids are their kids are our age, kind of thing.
And what also sort of shocked me is that snowmobiles were first called ski-doos. This is where these were brand new. I mean, that's what people have to understand. The snowmobile technology, and I guess I never really contemplated it too much because I'm not terribly involved in snowmobile life. But these, like you say, were just basically like lawnmowers that you could ride.
That's right, and they'd have to go over, like, you know, these huge ice ridges and carry them up and over and go around, and then they'd come across these patches of open water, and they were lunatics. They'd speed across it. I mean, if something went wrong, it was 10,000 feet down, you know, in minus 60 temperatures. So there is, I mean, if people check it out, and it's in the New York Times up on their website, and you can get to it my Facebook page. But if people read it, you'll see that they kind of came to a pact. We're gonna get there or die trying.
Did they have like photographs? Let me just ask you this one thing. Like when you met with the kids, like Walt Peterson's son, who was one of the, Peterson was one of the guys on there. And it, was he, he's the last one alive, right?
Peterson is still, he's the last one who made the whole trip. There are other members of the expedition, one of which didn't make the whole trip. And some of the other guys are from base camp, but he's the last one that did the whole thing. He's very ill. He's 88 and very, very ill.
But when you talk to his, I'm like, did they have like photographs? Did they have
totally they have these shrines? Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, you go to the garage or the basement of these kids out in Minneapolis as I did, and they're all like, why are these things not in the Smithsonian? Why does no one care about this? And the story of that is that Ralph was, you know, enormously egotistical. He was difficult, and he had a low attention span, so after he didn't get the recognition, he just gave up and moved on to other things. And I think a lot of it, too, though, is about, you know, the historical correct way to be a hero. Mm. And this is a story of an anti-expedition. This is a story of, you know, of the 21st century. I don't know. I guess it's just sort of an ironic tale, but, you know, it's a ripping yarn.
Yeah, and I love the part about where Peterson's son told you that they all took psychological tests to determine their suitability for this. They all failed. all right, I want to move on to some other stuff, but people should go check out this story. It's awesome. And someone just IM'd me, I should say, that the name Ski-Doo came from a typo. They wanted to call the
company.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. I'm Canadian. It was Bombardier. It was a Canadian company. It's one of those things where, you know, like you have these words that you use that no one in America can understand. And I refer to snowmobiles as Skidoos because that brand was so prominent in Canada.
Wow.
Ski dog.
All right. Well, let's talk. I want to get to U.S. politics. But today it was reported. I guess this happened. I don't know if this happened today in Europe or yesterday. But the former Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, and I may be pronouncing that
Karadzic,
was sentenced and found guilty, but he was sentenced to 40 years in jail for being criminally responsible for the 95 genocide in Srebrenica, which I'm not pronouncing correctly.
You got it. You're pretty good.
But this is the highest ranking, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Can you call it official or at least leader who has now been sentenced to jail because, Milosevic died before he could be. But you did some reporting in the Balkans, and your buddy Scott Anderson, who was on this program for the
Lawrence of Arabia.
In Arabia. Tell me, you know, put this in some type of context for us.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest way to think about it is that you listen to these politicians talk about Muslims and Middle Eastern peoples as it being uniquely bloodthirsty and, ethnically and culturally violent. You need to remember there was genocide occurring in the heart of Europe within our lifetime. And the Balkans was a bloodbath. And this guy Karadzic was not just like a war criminal. He was a kind of to the Serbian people, they had this spasm of extreme nationalism after the downfall of the Eastern Bloc and, you know, Yugoslavia disintegrating. You know, he was held up as a hero. I mean, he was, you know, lots of people provided him sustenance and hid him out for many years in the Balkans, this guy who had been responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent civilians in the Balkans. I covered the Serbian war with Albanian, ethnically Albanian people in Kosovo shortly after this. But my buddy Scott Anderson, a war correspondent, kind of a career one, he and a few of his friends went in search of Karadzic after he was in hiding, and they went up into the mountains. And the funny thing about it was they were just a bunch of journalists just kind of having a reunion and a kind of a joke. They weren't expecting to find him. They got mistaken for CIA guys, and all of a sudden they were being harassed and chased around these places by these Balkan thugs. But it shows you that there was a culture of very often in these kinds of situations, ethnically ethnic violence. There's a lot of self-pity underneath it. And the Serbians had a narrative of self-pity, and they had a narrative that they'd been the victims of this, you know, of the Croatians and the Albanians and everyone closing in on them, and ultimately the Americans. And Karadzic was seen as like somebody who stood up for the Serb people. And I'm sure you have ethnically Serbian listeners, and I'm sure they're getting offended even now. But the fact of the matter is the crimes were committed, and then those criminals were given succor in those countries. And it's useful to remember that this was Europe and only 20 years ago.
Right. I mean, it is amazing how that's sort of been erased from history in some respects. I mean, it hasn't been erased, but it's just, it doesn't, it is almost a relentless sort of narrative now. And maybe, you know, part of that is because of Trump, but there's also, you know, nominally people on the sort of like liberal left, supposedly, you know, like Sam Harris types, I don't even know if you're aware of, are making this argument that there's something fundamentally wrong with Islam that creates this type of violence, I guess.
Here's a thought for you. The United States of America, as a government, without a declaration, went and murdered maybe 500,000 or more Vietnamese.
Well, I mean,
on a false pretext. I mean, if you really want to talk
domino
about
theory.
One society having...
I mean, come on.
No, I know, but my point being, though, that, you know, the idea that violence perpetrated against the West is uniquely one-sided, or that there's, like, no moral equivalence between these things strikes me as absurd. And to label Muslims as, like, uniquely violent is certifiably insane.
Well, you just say that because you're Canadian.
Well, there you go. If you think you've got a problem with Muslims,
what do you make to that argument the argument that they would say was, well, when we killed those Vietnamese civilians, that wasn't our goal. Our goal was not to do that.
Right.
Our goal was to fight.
Carpet bombing by accident.
Well, we just thought that, you know, there were people just who were on the wrong carpet or something like that. I mean, that was not the agenda. If we could have avoided civilian casualties, we would have. I mean,
the one thing about being in conflict zones is that it teaches you just a lot about the power of violence and how terrifying it really is. And, you know, anybody who's, you know, you will not find people who've been in war zones lightly going off to war.
Right.
You just won't. And that's, Donald Trump, talk about chicken hawks. You know, how many exemptions or whatever did he have? And he's just ready. And Ted Cruz, you know, these guys are just, and Hillary Clinton as well, I would argue. You know, these people who have really no experience of this kind of collective violence find it, you know, is the first resort.
Right.
It kind of is astonishing to me that that the rhetoric of this country is so unself-reflective. That's not to say, that's not to make excuses for these lunatics, man. I mean, I was living in New York for 9/11. I saw the towers go down. You know, that was an incredibly awful, awful time. And all the years since, I don't think this country's recovered.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, I think that in some ways it's metastasized at the very least in the Republican Party, but I think sort of more broadly speaking, that scar has not just not healed. It's sort of like getting a little gangrene-y around the edges.
I was in Damascus a couple of years ago for Rolling Stone. I interviewed Omar bin Laden, the son of Osama. Omar had been up in the mountains of Afghanistan with his father. He'd been out in the desert in Africa with him, and of course he'd been in Saudi Arabia and all throughout. I mean, it was his father, and take a little digression to note that the night I met him in Damascus, he took me out to a strip club.
Mm.
So that was an unexpected turn of events. He wanted to go, but he said to me, he said, "Look, my father is winning. This is what he wanted."
Right. Just that the is dragging the U.S. into a conflict where they couldn't get out of in some ways.
Yeah. To draw them in, as ISIS continues to want to try to do. But also to, you know, to appeal to that part, the panicked part, the terrorized part of society, which, of course, Donald Trump is, you know, a master at accessing. That's basically his whole campaign.
Indeed. And it seems to only be resonating amongst Republicans at this point. I mean, who knows what happens when it turns to the general election. But if, you know, I'm always sort of suspicious of like hypothetical poll matchups. But his unfavorability rating is going up in the Republican Party and it's going down in the rest of normal America. But I do want to note.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a way that with the establishment and the Republican Party, and now you're going to find that America sort of wishes this away. You know, oh well, everyone's going to wake up one day and realize he's a buffoon or
right.
something. But I'm not sure that's true. I'm really not sure that's true. You know, I did something interesting this week, Sam. I was in Midtown Manhattan with a buddy of mine, and he has a kid in college, a freshman. He actually lives in Australia. And I thought his kid's kind of a cool kid, and I thought, you know, it would be really funny to walk around campus in Australia as a freshman with a Make America Great Again cap on. I just thought that would be a really funny thing to give a kid. So I went shopping for one. You can't buy one. They're not for sale. And I went into all these stores, and here's why. All the trinket stores and the hat stores and the tourist stores in New York City, or the vast majority,
uh-huh.
are run by Muslims.
Yeah.
And they were furious. I went in and said, hey, like jokey woke, you know, big joke, ha ha, I got to make great American hat again, hat here. And they all just said, what do you mean? Make it great. Get out. They were angry.
Yeah.
And afraid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've mentioned on this program that, you know, Myla has, you know my daughter, but my 10-year-old yeah. daughter has a friend in school who is Muslim, who is talking in school about how her parents are worried that they may have to move out of the country.
Yeah, and my kids, same age as Myla's, they have a Muslim girl in their class, and they have this one boy who's like the notorious dummy boy, who's all pro Donald Trump and Muslims should go home. And I said to my kids, why don't you go ask him what Sana should do? Should Sana go home? Where's home for Sana? That's the little girl, little Muslim girl.
And what happened? Now there's a huge.
Well, they. I mean, you know, I didn't make them go do it. I just, you know, rhetorically. You know, it's astonishing that this has entered the discourse. Ted Cruz, they're going to surveil Muslims. How's that going to work? How are you going to tell?
Well, I don't know how. I guess you'd have to have a new type of federal police, right? I mean, you'd have to have a special squad of the FBI. That would,
so,
I mean,
my wife has brown skin. So what, she'd be like presumed Muslim until what?
Well, yeah, I mean, does she have problems when she flies?
No, not at all. But, you know, we were in Morocco a bunch of years ago and everyone just kind of assumed she was Moroccan.
Right.
You know, if you put her down in Egypt, they think she's Egyptian. She happens to be Indian, half Indian. And she just has a skin tone that could be anywhere from Morocco to, you know, to Bangladesh.
And so, what I mean, when you talk to like folks who are, you know, I don't know how many peeps you talk to in Canada, but I mean, what is the perspective there? I noticed your buddy Trudeau said that he could work yeah. with Trump. I imagine you sort of have to say that, right?
Say that. He didn't quite say that. He didn't quite say that. What he said is he has faith in the American people.
Right.
Which every Canadian knows is saying you can't be really going to elect that dude. But, you know.
Well, you have to, as a leader, you have to say you can't, like, mess with other people's politics, right? I mean, theoretically, right?
I mean, I think the answer to your question is not, you know, I don't have to speculate. I can tell you how they would respond and what they think. During the recent Canadian election, which Justin Trudeau, won a very sweeping majority, there was a crucial moment in that election. Stephen Harper had been the Prime Minister of Canada for a decade or so. He had run on essentially Islamophobic terms, and had, you know, done nothing to let Syrian refugees into Canada, even though it's a nation of immigrants and has always accepted war refugees as a fundamental part of national identity in Canada. And there was a little boy who washed up on the shores of Turkey. And he had family in Canada, and he and his family were trying to escape from Syria, and this little four-year-old boy died. He drowned in this, you know, this death-defying, not this death, this lethal attempt to escape. And this became a huge issue in the country because under a different regime, he may well have been in Canada instead of on a beach dead.
Mm.
And there was a debate there was a debate, and the three main candidates were on the stage. There was a left of center. Trudeau is more of a centrist than this right of center candidate. And they were talking about revoking citizenship from anybody, any Canadian, who is found guilty, quote-unquote, of terrorism, which, as you've seen in this country, material support and all those kinds of definitions can mean a lot of things, and it's a pretty broad-ranging accusation. Anyway, Harper said, well, you know, as if it was obvious that there were lesser citizens of a country, that if you were, quote-unquote, a terrorist, which is code for Muslim, that you were a second-class citizen. And Trudeau stood up on the stage with this 10 years experienced prime minister and said, a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. And it's, you can't revoke citizenship. You can't choose who you get to honor as a Canadian, or as Stephen Harper called it, old stock, which means white. And that was a galvanizing moment in the Canadian election. That was the moment that things changed. And Trudeau went from running in, you know, a sort of an even third place to far and away first place. It was a moment when Canadians kind of recaptured what it means to be Canadian. And this is not something that's like done through dog whistles or subterfuge. This is a direct political rhetoric of the Prime Minister of Canada. And I went up and wrote about it for the New York Times Magazine. And I have to say, as a Canadian, it was a moment where I really felt the country was bringing itself to its senses. So can the United States have a moment like that this cycle? Can Hillary Clinton, would she have the political courage to do that in the face of Donald Trump? I doubt it.
Well,
I
mean,
honestly doubt it.
I mean, I think to a certain extent she gave a speech yesterday, I think it was, or 2 days ago, that was, you know, sort of close to that. I just don't know that the issue is really that it would take that a politician could make that difference, right? I mean, you know,
or that the American public would respond in the
well,
way
that's the I think is the problem, is that there's something fundamentally different about the American American population writ large versus the Canadian one, and I'm not sure I have a sense of what that is, other than, you know, with all due respect to people from the South, you know, a lot of Southerners. I mean, there's a lot of
things going on in this country that I think can explain it. And, you know, I read an interesting piece on 538 about yesterday, the Nate Silver's website, about why Donald Trump. And there's this kind
of
like
I saw that.
Collective head scratching. Yeah, there's this collective head scratching going on. And I mean, some part of it's got to be that the country's getting browner. It's getting
gay and lesbian, right? Some part of it. Wait a second. Here, I got a poll that was taken at the beginning of March.
Yeah.
Percentage of each candidate's supporters who say whites losing out is a bigger problem in this country due to preferences for blacks and Hispanics than they say.
Let me guess, Donald Trump 100.
That blacks and Hispanics losing. And this is Republican leaning registered voters. 54% of Trump voters say yes. And, you know. Then, you know,
that's an irrational thing. How do you assuage that? How do you address that?
I don't think you do. I mean, I think you just, you know, slowly try and make sure that these people don't have the levers of power and let them slowly die out over generations. I mean,
what Trudeau did. Because, you know, Canada, the old stock Canada has the same thing, right? I mean, it's a lesser extent and has a different history, obviously, and a different political system. But on some level, I think it's really important to make it explicit, to talk about it. Because if it comes in the form of polling rather than political rhetoric, it never gets dealt with and people are never required to confront the reasons they're doing things and then to try to rationalize them. So, you know, this is where Hillary Clinton and her sort of the way she and her husband do this kind of like a third way Tony Blair form of politicking, which is, you know, you never ever sort of take a stand on anything. Everything's trying to triangulate and attract that white voter. You know, it can work in the short term, but I think in the long term, it's not a great solution. And I think Trudeau took a different route. And I think Obama has to a significant extent as well.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I think Clinton has been not as bad on that particular issue, frankly. I think she's been pretty decent. But the problem I think that we have is that built into our political system, because of the nature of Congress and the Senate and the idea that, you have these sort of so many different sets of agendas that, you know, it's 42% of all Republican voters believe that. 42% of that party believe that, and not just believe it, are willing to say it to a to a pollster, right? So, you know, God,
to a stranger,
right? Exactly. And I mean, they believe it, and so the problem is that those 42% are represented almost perfectly, you know, by a bunch of congresspeople who are in, you know, our 15 districts where they're not going to lose to anybody ever unless they get outflanked on the right on these issues. And so these voters hear it reinforced by some people in their leadership. So it's not enough. Like, they're not going to listen to Hillary Clinton anyways, because frankly, you know, I'm not convinced that if you, you know, you asked this question and substituted women, that the numbers would be too far off from that as well. Like, men are losing out because women in the workplace are getting too, you know, they're demanding more money and blah, 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 feminazis.
But some of it's not completely irrational, right? Like the transformation of the workplace, the loss of decent...
Absolutely.
Loss of decent jobs, path to a middle class, a high school education getting you to a place in life where you can... All these guys that did that North Pole expedition... All except a couple were like high school guys.
Right.
Maybe finished high school, maybe didn't. Their generation, that could lead to a prosperous middle class existence, and that just doesn't happen anymore. And again, this is globalization. You can talk about big issues like that. But the point being that I think that these anxieties are not completely irrational. And so when you fail to address them through things like addressing the inequality of wealth and minimum wages and things like that, you know, the irony, of course, is that, you know, do you think Donald Trump cares about the working people of America? Anything but Donald Trump? I mean, it's just so abject.
He wants to make America great again.
You can buy all the hat. Pity you can't get a hat like that in Midtown Manhattan. I thought that was really interesting.
It is sort of surprising that particularly like amongst those type of shops, which will jump on any meme out there.
Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess it just makes it that much more valuable to get it on. I mean, to a certain extent, you could say what's going on in Midtown Manhattan is Sharia, because they will not sell those hats.
That's right. Donald Trump would turn that into something like that.
Right.
Donald Trump would open 50 hat shops. Oh, no, you know what he'd do? He'd have someone else do it. And then he'd lend his name to it, because he actually doesn't do anything anymore. He just brands it.
He would just brand it, of course. Well,
and he'd say it's worth $10 billion.
There you go. Guy Lawson, always a pleasure. What is your Twitter handle again? Isn't it like a weird one? Like, didn't you get into this so late?
You tried to get me a proper one. It's Guy Lawson 2, GUYLAWSON 2.
Oh, did you score 2? Because I thought you were like at, like... You got into that so late. Like, we had to drag you into getting a Twitter handle. I thought it was like Guy Lawson 534789A.
No, Guy Lawson at AOL, right?
Right. Guy Lawson 2. And what's your Facebook page? Is it Guy Lawson?
It's just Guy Lawson author. That's where I actually post. I go on Twitter once in a while, but not really. I mean, I just can't. I don't know. I mean, I like long-form journalism, and I like talking to you, Sam, because we can actually have a conversation instead of, like, a little one-minute soundbite.
I know. You go on.
That's part of the pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you go on, like, CBS or the morning show or whatever, they rush you in, rush you out. They just want to put makeup on you, buddy.
Yeah, no, I was on there one time on, I think it was MSNBC, and they said to me, so, this is my arms-dealing book. And they said... So you're trying to tell me that the Pentagon is deliberately proliferating weapons into the Middle East and Afghanistan that are less than good quality, and this is what they mean to do? And I said, yes. And the host just looked at me like, we'll go to commercial.
Oh, jeez.
It's up. It's actually up on YouTube. I think it's called something like, watch a journalist try to tell TV hosts, you know, something... like what political reality is, and it's really pretty funny.
Oh, we got to get that.
In a tragic way.
We'll play that on the show. Guy, we'll talk to you soon. Guy Lawson, everybody, thanks so much, Guy.
Thanks, Sam. Ciao.
All right, folks, we've got Guy's piece up on majority.fm. And, of course, go and if you have not read Arms and the Dudes, you're making a huge mistake. Or any of Guy's books, for that matter. He did amazing reporting on the Mexican drug cartels. I don't know if he was the first to do that, but he certainly was an extremely early one. And the octopus is also completely off the hook. In fact, they're making HBO, I think, is like still in production or is going to make a movie about that book. And Arms and the Dudes, I think, is coming out as a movie. I think they're calling it like War Dogs or something like that. I don't know why they that's a bad name, if you want my opinion. But I don't think he had anything to do with that. Guy also wrote The Brotherhoods, which is a... what's that?
I'll tell you when we're off. It's funny what show Guy was on for this.
Oh, it was The Cycle?
Yes.
You got to send me that.
We got to tweet it at us. I think you're in the tweet.
Okay. All right. Well, I can't get Twitter because my stupid web browser's not updated because our computer's too old.
Schlonged.
I got schlonged. I got schlonged. I got to update these computers. It's been a while, but we'll watch. We'll play that YouTube thing, and maybe we'll do a random rush today. It's been a while, ladies and gentlemen. We've got some sound. I don't know. You know, I got people who tweet at me are like, you got to play that sound of the Alabama governor who was talking about wanting to, I guess, just hold his AIDS breasts.
I thought when he starts crooning sexual healing to her, it was definitely worth it.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. No.
Well, I mean, it sounds like
it wasn't that amazing.
But
I'm not so hot on that sound, but if he had done a sexual healing rendition, I would definitely be.
Yeah, if it was a good song. Yes. But we won't get to that. But we will play a clip or two of Bernie Sanders on with Cenk. I have yet to see the whole interview, but my understanding is really a good interview. And we'll also listen to President Obama announcing that the administration is going to release documents regarding U.S. military and intelligence community's role in Argentina's dirty wars. And apparently, I mean, this is the first thing that occurred to me, was there are records, apparently, of Kissinger, who was Secretary of State as late as, in 76. And he had as of recently, classified secret transcript of a conversation on Argentina with the Assistant Secretary for Latin America, William Rogers, informing Kissinger that for the military government to succeed, the generals will have to make a considerable effort to involve the United States, particularly in the financial field. I think that's basically a way of saying, like, we should fund this.
Yeah. Like, there's this really hot startup going on in Argentina. They're rooted in the military, which is a very strong institution in that country.
It's totally disruptive.
Really disruptive and innovative ideas.
Completely
about
disrupting
rape and torture chambers.
Yeah, I mean, totally disrupting the idea of civil society.
They have this idea of drugging people, putting them up in helicopters, gutting their stomachs, and dropping them in the ocean, which is really one of the more dynamic ideas of body disposal that I've seen in the coup market.
And
we need to want to partner with this.
And Clinton's mentor and praiser, Kissinger, responds, yes, but that is in our interest.
It would be a good if.
Roger advises that we ought not at this moment rush out and embrace this new regime because he expects significant repression to follow the coup. But Kissinger says, they'll need a little encouragement.
What are you going to do?
I don't want to give them the sense they're harassed by the United States. There's nothing worse, honestly. And listen, I don't want to give relationship advice, but you don't want to be one of those types of superpowers that is constantly hectoring you know, these right-wing militias and generals who've got these paramilitary...
You have to seduce the
You don't want to hector them all the time about, like, don't kill so many civilians, or maybe you shouldn't torture these people, or, you know, disappearing people, or gutting them and throwing them out.
You have a beautiful candlelight dinner,
just, you know...
And then you criticize them?
You gotta let them have their space, all right? if you hold on too tight, sometimes... Just, you know, if you love something, let it go. If it comes back to you, it was meant to be. That's all I'm saying. And I think Kissinger understood that. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, speaking of the fun half, you know, this show relies on your membership to exist. And we call it a membership, but it's really not. I mean, it's not so much a membership, although it is. I mean... It's a way of supporting a program. This is just sort of one of the revenue models out there. And if we were to be doing a show that was focused on, you know, and this is where I always run into a problem, because the reason why we don't do this type of show is because I can't even name, like, I think Miley Cyrus is the last name I know in popular culture. And I have a feeling like that's like 10 years dated or something.
She's not covered on our program.
Right. But of that ilk, we could be doing gangbusters in terms of advertising revenue.
Gangbusters, eh?
But we don't. We do a show about politics. And so our revenue model is that we rely on you folks who listen to the program a couple of times a week to give us a couple of, you know, give us the quarter, the 50, the 35 cents that's in your pocket that day, give it to us. Now, it's impractical for you to put it in an envelope every day, because then you're actually, I mean, just think of the cost of the stamp itself would actually be a net negative. So what we do is we say, you know, join the Majority Report for pennies a day, and we set up a payment system, and then you can do that. And you can do that at jointhemajorityreport.com. And that is a way of saying thank you. We give you extra content. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link, majorityreportkickback.com. Don't like Amazon? Buy it from our link. At majorityreportkickback.com, you can buy stuff from jet.com, which is a great service and gives you 15% off your first order. I'll take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Be back in a moment. I don't know why I'm talking like this. I'll probably stop in the fun, huh?
It's kind of working.